Part 8, Chapter 25, Camp 2. On their active rest day at Camp 1, our fictitious climbers took a short hike into the Western Coombe. Today, they're actually going to move to Camp 2 at 21,000 feet. If it's sunny, it'll be a brutal trek. If it's cloudy, it's going to be a brutal trek. They want a Goldilocks experience, high clouds and light winds. "The route is into the South Col," Pisang told her. "This is excellent news. Now the Sherpas from all the teams could begin to take tents, stoves, and fuels and the critical oxygen bottles to what is the last camp before the summit." It also meant that the rope fixing team could fix the sections from the South Col to the balcony, South Summit, and eventually the summit. It appeared that Dawa's earlier prediction that the rope fixers would reach the top around May 5th was accurate. The schedule looked good for member summits to start around mid-May, just on schedule. As John Paul told everyone just before they turned in for another difficult night at altitude, "Let's be walking around 5 a.m. around sunrise, but have your headlamps on your helmet because it'll be dark. There are crevasses all over the place, as you saw yesterday, plus that ice cliff. Today, you'll need to climb and not turn back. C2 is not that far, but it's further than you think. And at times, it'll not feel real. Okay, sleep well, everybody." The second night was better for most people at Camp 1, but a few still struggled. The morning routine was faster now. They had honed their dressing and packing techniques. Well, almost all of them. Their packs were a reasonable weight for a member, around 15 to 20 pounds. But at altitude, everything is amplified. Each carried their sleeping bag, pads, and extra layer. The altitude became apparent as they strapped on their crampons and double-backed their harness buckles. With helmets on, they started walking. Their breathing picked up. Along a line of almost 14 people, they moved like snails at first. The route followed the boot path created by the Mount Everest guides and scores of other teams in the Coombe. The fixed line followed the track, or the other way around. Every few hundred feet, there was an anchor that required bending over and unclipping from the line and moving the safety carabiner over that anchor and then moving a second carabiner over it. It was tedious, but there was an element of safety that was non-negotiable. After an hour, they came upon the ice cliff. It was steep, a 30-foot snow wall that was actually part of a collapsed crevasse. There were no ladders, only two dangling ropes, one to climb up and the other one for rappelling down. Michael struggled with this setup on the training course at base camp, and now he was at 2,500 feet higher. He was with Jim and John Paul as they approached the obstacle. "Well, this is it," he said with significant anxiety in his voice. "Hell, I'll go first," Jim said as John Paul and Michael looked at each other with surprise. Like a pro, he slid his ice axe into the gap between his back and the pack and attached his Jumar to the rope. With a confident kick, the front points of his crampon engaged the wall. He slid the Jumar up a bit and took another step, kicking it again. He moved easily, with confidence, and he topped out. Michael looked at John Paul. They both just smiled. "Well, that's how you do it," John Paul offered with a smirk. Michael approached the wall like a heavyweight boxer to his opponent in round one. He slid his ice axe into a spare carabiner on his harness like a gunfighter, using his pistol and putting it into a holster. He attached the Jumar like Jim had. John Paul called out, "Use your legs to climb, not your arms. Slow, short steps with good purchase for your crampons. There's no need to rush." Jim monitored the activity from above, added, "And remember to breathe." Michael kicked his right foot into the wall. It bounced off. He tried again, this time with more force, and this time it stuck. The Jumar went higher. He kicked the other foot above the first. His body followed. Slowly, he climbed the wall, one short step at a time. Halfway up, he found steps kicked in by other climbers. He placed the front third of his right boot into the step. He paused to take a few deep breaths. "Good job," Jim greeted him at the top. John Paul, still down below, clapped his hands together, muffled with his gloves still on, and he let out a whistle. Michael smiled at both, pleased with his performance, a boost in confidence. He walked away from the wall a bit faster than his usual pace. The sun was peeking out now, rising over Lhotse. It was already after 7, almost 8 o'clock in the morning. They'd been moving for about 2 hours. Camp 2 is located in a rocky ravine thousands of feet underneath the south summit of Everest. It serves as advanced base camp for most expeditions, with permanent cooks, large dining tents, and a long table, tablecloths, fake flowers, and golf-style chairs. They shared sleeping tents. "This is luxury compared to 14 camp on Denali," Pablo said. "Yeah, I like it, but I feel bad for the Sherpas who had to haul all the stuff just for our comfort," Claudia agreed. Buddy's again in the lead, crest of a small hill. We're almost there, they told a Sherpa. He just smiled and said, Bastardi, fair, far. They kept walking, confident about being the first to camp like they were to Camp One. The competitive nature of the duo was becoming obvious to everyone else. They weren't sure it was a good thing. One stopped suddenly bending over and started his familiar cough. Their Sherpa stopped him with waiting for the pace for the episode to pass. Bastardi, Bastardi, slowly, slowly. They walked a bit slower now and saw a tiny red tent off in the distance. Encouraged, they picked up the pace, but the coughing soon returned. Another hour passed. The red tent seemed to have multiplied. Now there were a line of them. They crested another hill as the sun was hitting the climbers hard. They stopped to strip off their jackets, stripped down now only wearing a thin nylon white short-sleeved shirts and a bandana in their ball cap to drape over their necks. They felt cooler. At C1, they had lathered up with sunscreen, but now reapplied as sweat was wiping it away. Harper came up behind him as they took a break. She had done similar changes a little bit earlier. Now she was in a nylon top. Sweating at 20,000 feet in short sleeves, Harper said. Where's our camp? She asked the Sherpa. Last one at the top of the hill, he said, not making eye contact for good reason. They continued as a group of four, reaching the rocky bottom of the ravine. They chose not to take off their crampons, even though most of the snow was gone. The angle increased. Thus far, over the previous 2 miles, it was steady, almost imperceptible. Now they could feel it. Pausing for another break, they settled on a large boulder and drank the last of their water. Soon they could eat and drink at C2, if they ever got there. Higher and higher, they passed camp after camp spread out amongst the rocky terrain. Each camp looked the same, a large dining tent, another for cooking, surrounded by a sea of 2- and 3-person sleeping tents. A couple of tall blue tents marked the toilets. Here, the Sherpa called out. The three members looked up from staring at their boots. Thank God, Bart said, and started coughing. They dropped their packs by the dining tent and quickly sat in a chair. Hot lemon tea and crackers were on the table. They ate and drank with urgency. The couple soon joined them. Look at that, Dutch called out. He, Tony, Jim, Michael, and Jean-Paul were together with Passong and a climbing Sherpa. The Lhotse face, Dutch said with reverence. Jim let his eye trace the boot path towards Camp 3. That was as far as I got last year, he said to himself, not out loud. He was pleased with his performance today, especially on the ice cliff. He had more confidence. He felt okay, not great, not strong. He was tired like he expected, but not as tired as he had feared. That's a big test, Jean-Paul said to the team. Everyone looked up, and then everyone looked down. They seemed to look down their boots more than they looked up at the mountains. Chapter 26, Acclimatizing at Camp 2. Now at Camp 2, 21,000 feet, the team began to adjust to the extreme altitude. There's no way to avoid acclimatizing if you want to summit Mount Everest almost 8,000 feet higher. Okay, your job for the next 2 days is to make as many red blood cells as possible, John told the group with a silly grin on his face. He was starting to relax as the group bonded. Being high on the mountain, he was in his element. This was his house, his church, his life. While tired, the entire team now felt confident. Most took between 3 and 4 hours to make the trek from Camp 1 to Camp 2, but now the real work began, the process of acclimatization. Just as they arrived at Camp 2, a helicopter rescue was underway. It's becoming more and more common to see helicopters Camp 2 despite the extreme altitude. They didn't know who it was or what the problem was, but they watched with care as it flew away. So what's the secret? Dutch asked the group. No secret, no tricks. Just let the body do what it naturally does, adjust to the less oxygen available, Aaron responded, one of the buddies. Correct. However, there are several ways to accelerate the process, Jean-Paul chiming in. He began a tutorial. Acclimatization. It's a strange word that evokes a lot of emotion for many people. Fundamentally, it means adapting the human body to the altitude where it was not designed to survive. Even though the percentage of oxygen in the air on Everest summit is the same as at a beach on Rio, there are fewer molecules available to inhale. That's because there's less atmospheric pressure. Thus, the oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide molecules, they just spread out. It's the opposite of what a diver experiences with pressure increasing as a diver goes deeper. Harper feels more weight, more pressure, whereas a climber has less oxygen available. That's why they call it thin air. But the big problem is what is called the pressure gradient. It's the difference in pressure between two surfaces. At sea level, those little sacs in our lungs, the alveoli, use the pressure, the difference in the pressure to pump oxygen into the bloodstream. So as a human goes higher, that pressure decreases and breathing becomes more difficult, as does getting oxygen into the bloodstream. At this point, everyone was paying close attention. So that's why I'm out of breath, Jut joked. No, it's because you smoke. I saw you vaping in Kathmandu, Jim shot back. That was medical, Dutch said with a smirk. What happens in our bodies to adjust to this problem, Michael asked. Well, honestly, I felt okay until I got to 23,000 feet. And then I felt like I couldn't get enough air, no matter how slow I went. Jean-Paul thought for a moment and speculated. Well, maybe you weren't as acclimatized as you should have been. Michael looked back. Well, we did go up pretty fast. Jean-Paul continued. Right now, here at Camp 2 at 21,000 feet, our bodies are changing. Over the next few hours, the hormone in trotospion, that is responsible for creating red blood cells, kicks into high gear. At the same time, our blood plasma goes down. So the percentage of red goes up in our blood count. And that's just what we want. After a couple of days, we're pretty much adjusted short of staying here for several weeks to the current altitude. So that's why we stay here just for about 2 days. We're putting money in the blood bank for this on this four-day rotation. There's a bunch of other stuff going on, like our heart rate increases, so does our breathing rate, and we pee a lot to get rid of that extra carbon dioxide we create. Because the pressure difference, it's harder for our system to get oxygen into our muscles. Speaking of which, they start to lose muscle mass. Also, our VO2 max goes down. Mine can't go much lower, Jim said with a sigh. Yeah, it goes down with age, Jean-Paul said, nodding his head. There's a way to accelerate this acclimatization process, a way to make it shorter, Pablo asked. I struggled on Denali, and that's about where we are right now, around 20,000 feet. Hey, what's up with those tents up there? Tony looked up. For the first time, he seemed engaged in a conversation. I slept in one of those for the last 2 months. Everyone in their head turned in unison, hoping that he would join the group. I set the generator to simulate 20,000 feet in my altitude tent back home. It's different than what we feel now with fewer molecules. The generator changes the ratio of oxygen and nitrogen. But still, like Jean-Paul was saying, my hemocrat levels went up. I feel good now. I hope sleeping in that plastic bag for 2 months was worth it. My ex-girlfriend didn't think so. Dutch looked at him. You had a girlfriend? Everyone laughed as Tony shyly smiled. We'll go on O's about Camp 3, right? Harper asked, anxious to leave the group and call home. Right. We sleep at half a liter a minute at Camp 3, and then on the climb to the coal, we'll go up to 2 liters per minute, and then we'll crank it to 4 on the summit push. We've used that formula for a long time, and it works well. Jim just looked away. He had bought the extra oxygen option, so he would use almost double those flow rates. He decided this was his last chance, and he was going to use every advantage that he could find. All right, that's it for tonight. Tomorrow we go to the base of the Lhotse Face for an active rest day. The key to maximizing our acclimatization right now is number one, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Drink as much as you can overnight. I want your pee bottles full, if not running over in the morning. Second, I want you to eat as much as you can manage. The best way to not summit is to lose too much weight. So let's eat. Our cooks are great and they'll give you all you want. And there's plenty of water, so don't worry about that either. Finally, we must stay active to reduce the lactic acid buildup that comes with all these changes we're discussing and to keep our cardio working and adapting. Everybody got it? All right. Good night. Jean-Paul left the tent. Dutch and Tony, the couple, left as well. Jim and Michael and Buddy stayed behind for one round of cards. Not tonight, Harper said. I'm off to call home, she said, zipping up her down jacket and taking his cell phone out of her pocket. It was only 7 p.m., a bit too early for bed, but she really wanted to hear her family's voices. Hi, honey. We miss you so much. How are you? Where are you? He answered the phone, recognizing a 13-digit phone number coming from somewhere outside of his local area code. At Camp 2, got here today. I'm good. He sensed something different in her voice. Harper was 45, and they had been married in their early 20s. Now with 2 children plus her mother living with them, their lives were busy. Harper was a primary breadwinner for the family, but Everest had always been her dream. He supported her in all ways. He knew her well. Now he was worried. Tell me everything. How are the kids? I want to talk to them. How are you? I miss your smell at night. Honey, how's mom? Chapter 27, Sherpas at Camp 2. Living for the season at 21,000 feet, the Cooks are the backbone of any Everest expedition along with the climbing Sherpas. Our fictional team is busy creating red blood cells. They spend another night at camp too. "What was that noise?" Michael asked, shaking his head after jolting awake. "The cook's banging pots. Time for breakfast," Jim replied. "I'm hungry," Bart said to his buddy as he got out of the tent. "I can't seem to get enough food in me up here. I know what John Paul said about eating and losing weight, but it's impossible. I just can't get enough." Members of climbing Sherpas can burn 6,000 calories or more each day while climbing Everest. It's almost impossible to replace those calories, so most members do lose weight, maybe 5 to 10% of their body weight. "What's for breakfast?" Harper asked, poking her head inside the cook tent. "Pancakes, maple syrup, bacon, and toast," Childem said, revealing a big smile and a gold tooth. The cooks at Camp 2 are amazing. They're up before dawn. They go to bed after everyone else. Childem is the chief cook at Camp 2, and Kancha is his cook boy, a term commonly used on expeditions. They climb through the Khumbu Icefall along with many of the other Mount Everest guide Sherpas early in the season to set up camp. Unlike the other big mountains, for example, on Denali or Choyoyu or Kilimanjaro, the camps above base camp are minimal. No tables, chairs, or large eating tents. "Why do you have such luxuries on Everest?" Dutch asked Tony. "Because it's more competitive when we pay for it," he said, kind of glancing away with a sense of embarrassment. Kancha banged two pans together for what seemed like an eternity, or at least until he saw members slowly making their way towards the large dining tent. He had set the table with plates, plastic coffee cups, several large containers filled with hot water. While the members were in camp, he would do this 3 times a day. In between meals, Kancha carried 2 large buckets that he filled with water of more ice and snow to be melted back in the cook tent. He would make 4 or 5 trips each day to the water hole. The gas stoves were always on throughout the day. Even though the boiling point of water is lower at altitude, around 180 degrees Fahrenheit at 20,000 feet, this compares to 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. It's all because of the lower air pressure. Same reason that we have fewer oxygen molecules. So it takes longer to generate heat, thus longer to bring water to boil. "And we double boil the water," Childem said. "Camp 2 is very dirty. Humans are messy and pollute the snow and the water, so we have to boil and boil again, so make sure our members stay healthy." This extra measure meant more trips through the icefall to bring up fuel. Another reason some of the guys preferred the Tibet side. Childem performed magic with his cooking. Every item from sugar to flour to bacon and eggs had to be carried through the icefall, all on the backs of humans. No yaks, no mules. Not all the support was ethnic Sherpa. Some were Tamang, Gering, and Rai, but most were climbing support were their ethnic Sherpas. Long before any member arrives in Kathmandu, the head cook for base camp and Camp 2 created menus. They take great pride in their cooking. From experiences on previous expeditions, they know that members need more protein than the Sherpas. And also they like variety, but this was difficult at Camp 2. Back at base camp, porters brought in fresh food daily, but at Camp 2, it was dependent upon the climbing Sherpas to refresh the supplies. Cooking for the Sherpas was simple in comparison. Breakfast was usually sampa, a roasted barley porridge, and sayon, a wheat paste washed down with cups of Tibetan tea, a concoction of black tea with yak butter and salt. It seemed like something only the Sherpas would enjoy. When climbing, most Sherpas skip lunch because breakfast is so filling, but some carry thick dough-like balls of roasted barley flour mixed with tea, beer, or water to snack on. "Mingma, would you like a honey stinger bar?" Harper asked her personal Sherpa. No, Dadivant. "We never eat what you do," he said with a smile. "Yes, and I don't like Dalbot," Harper teased him back. They both laughed hard. Dalbot's a staple of any Sherpa diet and what most prefer for their dinner helpings. Many helpings. It's simple, a pile of white rice covered with curried vegetables and lentil juice. Maybe a little chicken, beef, or goat, if it's available, for extra protein. Just as the members were finishing up their pancake breakfast, they heard a fast talking and rustle outside of gear outside their tent. The climbing Sherpas were back from a carry to Camp 3 on the Lhotse face. Childem had got up at 2 a.m. to make breakfast for them. With headlamps on, 4 of the climbing Sherpas left in the dark, their backpacks full. "We carried 6 tents to Camp 3 and set them up for you," Purba told the couple. "But first, we had to make platforms to the tent," he added. "Platforms at 23,000 feet? Pablo asked curiously. Yes, it's very steep at Camp 3, so we have to take shovels, use ice axes to smooth out an area so the tent is flat. We sleep there too, so we also want it to be comfortable. How much did your packs weigh? Claudia asked Pimble and another climbing Sherpa. 20 kilos. Not too much, he said with a small grin. Not too much. That's 45 pounds, Harper looked at him. And climbing up the Lhotse face? Sitting on his pack now, Pimba began to describe what a climbing Sherpa does. Our job is to help you climb the mountain. Some people say that they don't need us, and some very, very strong climbers don't. But this is our job right now. We try to get all the camps set up before you get there. Oxygen bottles at the high camps as well. Oxygen is our biggest load. Each member will use about 6 cylinders, and each Sherpa about half of that, only 3. But we'll take up some spare bottles. Our team will use over 100 bottles, and each one has to be carried to Camp 3 or to the South Col before we leave base camp for the summit in a few weeks. And we carry food and fuel and stoves also to the Col. Bart stepped away coughing again. Pimba observed him closely. As a personal Sherpa, we also climb by your side. Yes, you must climb by yourself. We cannot do that for you, but we can help. Working with John Paul, if someone gets in trouble, that's our job, to help. Sometimes that means we must ask you to turn around for your own safety and our safety. I have a wife and 4 children. By now, the entire team had left the dining tent and Kanju was already cleaning up. Mima added a thought to the group. Hey, everybody, we want you all to summit, members and Sherpas. The more summits I have, the more work I'll get in the future. But also, all of us, Sherpas and members, we all want to go home to our families. So please, let's be careful. Harper walked back to her tent to get her pack. Harper and Mingma were about to go on a walk to the base of the Lhotse face as part of their active rest day. She thought about how much goes on that she never knew, how hard the Sherpas work, the heavy loads they carry. While Harper and the rest of the members slept, they got up early, went to Camp 3, and came back down before most of the team had even woken up. Harper had worked hard to be on Everest and was working hard now to accomplish her dream and make her mother proud. But now she had another motivation to live up to the expectations of Mi'kmaq, to make him proud of her.